It's time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Sermon.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom. His shot rebound, great save by Dimko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
What's going on? How's your Thursday? Hope you're off to a great start. We're going to make your day better. That's what we do. It's Rintoul and Sermon, bird free from what I'm led to believe, but I guess I'll have to go to Karen for confirmation on that. How are you? Do you have any unwanted visitors today?
No unwanted visitors so far in my condo, Scott. That is very, it's very appreciated the birds have stayed outside. I can hear them outside the window, but so far I haven't flown in the door. I will say this, it's a little chilly in the condo this morning, so I have the door closed. Preventative measures for birds flying in, but also for to keep me a little warmer today. So hopefully there's no invasive, intrusive, you know, birds flying in or anything else coming into my condo today.
Well, send cooler temperatures east because a lot of folks around the BC interior and into Alberta that are dealing with wildfires right now could use some cooler weather as they try to get those under control. Mm-hmm. We are going to go to the BC interior a little bit later on this hour. Michael Riley, the quarterback of the BC Lions, is there. He's in Kamloops camp, one of the league's most prominent players. We will speak with him at the bottom of this hour. But speaking of prominent, Mike Riley's a guy who dealt with injuries. Shea Weber is apparently dealing with a lot of them. Let's start there because this was a really big story. We've had a lot of breaking news around the National Hockey League, and you hear about all of the injuries. And what a great clip from the NHL that got put out yesterday of John Cooper going through that handshake line with the Montreal Canadiens and referencing some of the injuries that the likes of Brendan Gallagher had suffered. That was a great piece of audio and a great piece of just camera work, wasn't it?
It was awesome, and I love the fact that John Cooper, in the moment where he's celebrating his second Stanley Cup, took the time to individually address each of the players, and especially the young players on the team, too. Yeah, I talked to Brendan Gallagher, but what he said to Nick Suzuki, he's like, this was a coming-out party for you. Keep your head down, work hard, and you're going to have a great career. Like, it was just great to hear that, and just to understand that he understands the moment for these kids as well. Yeah, it's on the losing side. He's been on the losing side, so he knows what it means. But keep your head going. You have a great career created. I thought it was wonderful just to have access to that.
Certainly, and I guess it's for the final edition of Quest for the Cup, which will be out on Friday on YouTube. I love the interaction with Carey Price as well, and some people might think that it's just going through the formatics and saying the right thing, but I felt like there was meaning behind it when he said for Carey Price, hey, man, I ache for you. Like, I understand that you are of such a level that you deserve something like this, so I feel badly for you. I'm not going to give this cup back, but I feel badly for you.
Also, keep your head up, kid, because I may be calling on you come February to be our starting goaltender for Team Canada at the Olympics. Maybe there's a little bit of that in there, but I just think that John Cooper's a really good guy. Did you hear that wrap-up that the Tampa Bay Lightning sent out, and it showed like his locker room speeches? He's just so passionate and well-versed, and there's just not really a lot about him that you say, you know, I just don't like this guy. I can't play for them. I wouldn't play for him. And it just showed again just how much compassion he does have for even the losing side when it's probably one of the most joyous days in his career.
Carey Price was at those 2014 Olympics. John Cooper was not. But as you mentioned, he might be at the next ones in 2022. They may become teammates there. Shea Weber, by the looks of things, won't be. This is a guy who was on the blue line in Vancouver in 2010. A guy who was on the blue line in Sochi in 2014, gold medals to show for both of those appearances. He is one of the great defensemen of this generation. Certainly, I believe that, and we will get to that conversation in a minute. Could his career be over? Hmm. It's too early to say. We know this guy's been playing in pain, Karen. We just didn't know how much. We can't definitively rule on how much his body has left to give. Shea Weber can't rule on that either. But this much is clear. His NHL future is very much in question. Here's Elliot Friedman last night updating the situation after he posted a story on Sportsnet.ca.
You know, Weber's body's been beaten up for a bit of time now. He's, as you know, he obviously plays a very physical game. He takes a lot out of other people. He's had some real foot and ankle problems on his left foot going back a few years now. He missed some time a couple years ago. He missed some time last year. He had surgery there a couple years ago. He had right knee surgery a couple years ago. His thumb was injured this year. And after I published the first article tonight, someone reached out to me and said, don't discount the seriousness of that particular injury too. I just think he's so beaten up right now, and his body's been through so much that, you know, at the very least, we're talking about a break here. Now, I know Renaud Lavoie, he reported tonight it was going to be a year. I don't know. All I was just told it was uncertain and it possibly could be the career. And what we're trying to figure out here is how the NHL feels about all of this. Weber has 5 years left on his contract. And if he was to retire, the Nashville Predators would be hit with a pretty substantial penalty, almost $5 million over the next 5 years. The Canadians would get about $500,000. And the league has to rule that Montreal can put him on long-term injury for as however long as he needs. And right now the league is going through that, and as yet they haven't approved it.
So as Elliot Friedman just detailed in that clip, Karen, there are a couple of parts to this. One is Shea Weber, the player and the person. The other is the business, the contract. And it's very difficult for some hockey fans to separate the two. I think we should do so verbally. And while many people are interested in the contract ramifications, I'm sorry, for me, who watched this guy play junior, he's a BC boy from Sicamous. His story is a great one. He wasn't highly touted coming into the Western Hockey League. He's not even a first-round draft pick, but boy, he built himself into the captain of a Memorial Cup-winning team. He built himself into a captain in Montreal. He's been fantastic for both the Predators. He is the epitome of tough, skilled, rugged, everything you want in an NHL defenseman. I got so much time for this guy.
I do too. And Scott, the first thing that I thought of when this report came out from Rand Lavoie was the fact that we saw the emotion on Shea Weber's face after they lost the Stanley Cup. And it made me think, okay, did he know something we didn't? Like, this is a player that has been a warrior in the NHL. This is a player that has played through injuries that we know about. This is a player that puts his body on the line. He puts everything on the line for his teammates and for what he has on the crest. And you saw the tears for the first time for Shea Weber. And at first it was, okay, it's his age. You know how close he got. Maybe that's the emotion. But maybe he knew more. Maybe he knew that his body was so broken that there's a chance that he was not going to have another chance to make it here, because he knew that this was probably, or possibly, one of the last games he's ever going to play in the NHL. And you saw his teammates go hug them. I don't know if they knew that or it was just the emotion and they wanted to give him some condolences for they couldn't win it for him. But that's, I don't know about you, but that's where mine went first. The tears. Did Shea Weber know a little bit more than, well, what we're finding out right now?
There are a couple of things that you chase, certainly from a team standpoint and then as an individual standpoint. And Shea Weber hasn't been able to get either pieces of hardware in the NHL. He got this close to getting a cup. He's been this close to grabbing a Norris Trophy at some point. He never actually got one. I don't think that will prevent him from getting into the Hall of Fame for a second. I think he is a no-doubt Hall of Famer. I'm not sure how you fashion a case against him unless you're going to say, well, I feel like you need to have a cup or a Norris. That's on my list. I believe we're changing the way we view that now. Many more teams than there used to be with some of the great players, and everybody made the playoffs, or so it seems, 16 of 21, and the chances of getting to the Stanley Cup final were better because of that. Look, Shea Weber's going into the Hall of Fame. He is the active leader in goals by defensemen right now. He's 15th on that all-time list. I don't know if he gets to play again and jump over the likes of Kevin Hatcher and Steve Duchesne, but he brings everything you're looking for in a defenseman. And when people talk about the individual trophies, that's not the only measure of greatness. Roberto Luongo is going to go in the Hall of Fame without a Vezina. He came close, but he never got one. He didn't get a cup, came close, but never got one. Shea Weber is going to be in the same category of goes into the Hall of Fame, but likely doesn't get his hands on either of those trophies.
Yeah, and, you know, back in the day, and you kind of look at some of the players that are in the Hall of Fame, Scott, their case is bolstered by the fact they are Stanley Cup champions. But at this point, when you're looking at players, it's so hard to win a Stanley Cup. It's especially so hard to win a Stanley Cup in the salary cap era. I don't think it can be held against you anymore, especially he's got gold medals to his name. So it's not the NHL Hall of Fame, it's the Hockey Hall of Fame. So I think you have to put that in consideration. Plus, think about that time, like, for a time when he was with the Predators, like, he was one of, if not the top defenseman in the league, probably in the conversation, top three or four. He was feared, right? Like, there was a conversation, well, one, you don't want to be hit by him in the boards because he's going to destroy you, and two, it's like, don't get in front of his shot because you will be hurt by that blast of a shot that he had, that Al MacInnis shot that he was compared to coming into the NHL. So I think that he definitely has a case. I mean, there might be a case whether he's a first ballot or not. You can go into that conversation, don't really want to go there, but for me, he's a definite Hall of Famer. I can agree with you on that. I can't really fashion a case that he's not.
No sympathy from Zetterberg comes the comment. That is reference to the Wings-Predators playoff series from years gone by and Shea Weber throwing Zetterberg into the turnbuckle. He should have been suspended for that. He wasn't. It was a bad non-call by the NHL in that instance, but it does speak to what you talked about. He was feared. You didn't want to go into the corner with Shea Weber.
We knew we would get these texts coming in. You and I discussed this before the show, like what kind of angles. We always have a conversation, what kind of angle we want to do. We said it's going to go one or two ways. We're going to get text messages talking about cap recapture and the Roberto Luongo situation with the Canucks, or the fact that, okay, this is LTIR, and come, you know, round one of the playoffs, Shea Weber will be all of a sudden healthy. And this comes from Dave and East Van. Weber and the Habs are pulling a Kucherov LTIR. Habs are in for a big signing. Hashtag naive sports media. Here's the thing. If you think losing a Shea Weber off the Habs roster, Scott, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel the fact that if you lose Shea Weber off this roster moving forward in the new in the division that they're going back into, Montreal's not even probably competing. Well, maybe competing, but they're not going to playoff team. Like, Tampa Bay Lightning build a complete team that they could afford to lose a Hart Trophy winner in the past, and they made the playoffs and they got him back, and I understand all that. But if you think that it's any comparable to what Montreal's situation was, it's not. You're losing your top defenseman. You're losing your top defenseman, and it's just not possible to compete with that.
Well, in this hypothetical world that Dave calling the media naive is creating, in that hypothetical world, you would free up Shea Weber's cap money, and you would be able to go out and put a bid in on Dougie Hamilton or another defenseman, or maybe you get Ryan Suter on the whatever it is. I have no idea. I understand where Dave's going with this. I don't believe, based on the person we're talking about here, that's what's happening in Montreal. And there's a lot of different theories out there. Hey, this is a smokescreen so that they don't have to protect Shea Weber, and Seattle's not going to select Shea Weber. That's part of the reason they're doing this, and this helps Montreal with protection issues, because Montreal is currently constructed. If they go 7-3-1 and they don't make any moves right now, probably they're going to have to expose Ben Chiarot. It'll be him or Joel Edmondson, and likely it's going to be Ben Chiarot. Do they want to lose one of those top four? Absolutely not. I don't know that that's what Seattle has its eye on anyway, but that is a likely, or at least it's a potential pick. Maybe they go with Jake Allen, which certainly helped out Montreal during the regular season this year. He was great for them when Carey Price was injured this year. I don't believe there's this level of pre-planning with a guy who has been as beat up as Shea Weber has. And if you read Arpan Basu, who's got a piece out there right now, one of the things about Weber is it's been a source of pride to him, because everybody said, well, the contract is set up for when you retire. From a personal standpoint, Weber apparently has wanted to prove people wrong on that. Like, I'm going to fulfill my obligation on the contract. The question now becomes, will his body actually allow him to do that?
Look, and that's why the NHL and the NHLPA are investigating this, because they're going to look if it's a legitimate injury. Can he go on long-term IR and maybe finish out his career on that sort of, in that situation? I mean, Marian Hossa, the league allowed that to happen with Marian Hossa and the Chicago Blackhawks. He went on LTIR in 2017 because of his career-ending skin condition. A lot of people questioned that at the time, Scott, because it was like, okay, Chicago needs some cap savings. Marian Hossa is on the downward trend of his career. How do they get that? Oh, they're going to use LTIR as a scapegoat. I don't think that this is Mark Bergevin's endgame, is to put Shea Weber. I don't think this is Shea Weber's endgame. I don't know if he would do that to Montreal and to Nashville. And look, like you said, there's two ways to look at this. We look at it as the player himself or the contract. Well, he goes, if he retires, Nashville's on, what, $4.9 million they're going to have against their cap for the next 5 seasons. They're going to get the cap recapture penalty. It's a little different than in the past, but still, $4.9 million. They've already got Kyle Turris. It's a big hit for them. But I don't think Shea Weber is also going to look at Nashville and goes, I want to screw them over.
Well, and is that what Luongo did? I have no idea why he chose to retire as opposed to go on LTIR after he had the back issues and he wasn't going to be able to continue his NHL career and fulfill the end of his contract. Vancouver obviously dealing with that cap recapture and one more year left, and there are a lot of bitter Canucks fans, and rightfully so. That contract was signed legally. Cap recapture is a joke with the way that it was brought in and went back, retroactively punishing teams that had signed legal contracts at the time. But let's get off that part for a second. That 4.91 is if Weber retires tomorrow. And we had this text come in from Gary. Regarding the Weber contract, the NHL brass must be looking for a way to get Nashville out of cap recapture without opening a door for Luongo's contract. It already exists. You just mentioned it with Marian Hossa, and I believe that is a legitimate skin condition. I looked at the detailed reporting on the stories that came out afterward with those who are questioning it. We've seen it with how many contracts in the past, whether it's by virtue of concussion or other injuries. You can go on LTIR if your body will not allow you to play, as long as you're willing to do that. In most cases in the National Hockey League, that's what happens. That's why the cap recapture with Roberto Luongo in particular was so surprising, because everybody assumed if he wasn't going to play anymore, he was going to do what everybody else had done. Simply go on LTIR. I've got a legitimate reason why I can't fulfill the terms of my contract here, but you're not going to get hit with this cap recapture penalty. That was the outlier, as opposed to what happens with most NHL players who find themselves in a situation where they're questioning their future.
Yeah, and look, I mean, if you're going to look at the legitimacy of the Shea Weber injuries, just go back to, what, offseason a year ago, there was conversation. Nick Kiprios put a tweet out that he took a lot of flack for, saying, you know, Shea Weber may not play again this year. Maybe his career is potentially in threat because of the knee and ankle and foot issues. And Shea Weber refuted it pretty quickly, and the Montreal Canadiens refuted it pretty quickly, Scott. But there is a precedent that, yes, this was out here before. So the fact that it's out there again, plus the thumb injury, and Elliot Friedman says don't discount how serious that injury could be as well. At some point, people's bodies shut down. Look at the way Shea Weber plays. At some point, your body just can't handle it anymore. Again, we don't know, and I don't know if he's ever going to play another game in the NHL, but I would not be surprised just with how long he's played, his age, and his body just saying, look, I can't do it anymore, and I can't play at the standard that I was willing to or being able to play the majority of my career at.
This text comes in. So why is it that they, the NHL, never investigated the Lightning? That's so BS for that dirtbag Kucherov. So now that Montreal needs this, the NHL investigation, effing Bettman. Incorrect. That's not a fact. The NHL did, in fact, investigate the Lightning. Nikita Kucherov had legitimate surgery. There seems to be this misconception out there that Kucherov just kicked back for a few months and was healthy and ready to go. Not, in fact, the case. Now, did Tampa Bay believe he was going to be ready for the playoffs when he underwent the procedure? Sure, I believe that. But he was legitimately not able to play for a number of months. Could he have come back earlier? Yeah, he could have. And if you want to talk about having a proactive measure in there that you got to play a certain amount of games, okay. I believe there are always going to be exceptions to the rule. I painted a hypothetical for you on this. Let's say a guy gets legitimately hurt in training camp with a serious injury, let's say an ACL, but he gets it repaired, and 8 months later, because his team's on a deep run, he's able to come back. Do you tell him he's not able to play? He was a legitimate part of the plans. Again, I know that is a very unique example, Karen. I'm just saying you can't guard against everything. And to your point earlier, very few teams, even if they wanted to, could afford to sit out a player of Nikita Kucherov's ability and then say, we'll be fine, we'll make the playoffs in what is anything but certainty in this National Hockey League.
I mean, you just look at how much they relied on that top four defense and Shea Weber in the playoffs. Scott, you point back to if he wasn't able to play last season in the North Division, is this Montreal team, with everything that they went through, being the fourth team, are they a playoff team? They didn't make the playoff run without Shea Weber. Like, they don't have him on that team. You do not make this playoff run. I am certain on that. You don't have him next season. That's a major hit to your roster that Mark Bergevin's going to have to find. Yeah, he goes on LTIR. Maybe he goes after one of those really sought after and a ton of defensemen now, Keith Yandel apparently out there. Not to say he can replace Shea Weber, but my point is, yeah, he gets a little flexibility to go after a now need that he has on his roster. But just the conversation that, yeah, he's going to go on LTIR and he'll be back for the playoffs, like, you take a player of that caliber, there is no guarantee that they would even make the playoffs in that division next year.
You mentioned Keith Yandel. That is one tidbit of news that has come down this morning. Did I hear Keith Yandel was just bought out? What happens to his Iron Man, asked one of the texters in here this morning. Question, because that streak looms. And I actually wonder, Karen, if it hurts Keith Yandel as far as the number of teams that would bring him in. Florida was going to healthy scratch him at the beginning of this past season. They thought better of it. There was pushback from the players in the room as well. They wanted Keith Yandel to play. Play he did. And if you remember, it was actually a pretty good story in game one. He scored. He scored in his first game back this season. His ice time has been beefed up by the power play. Florida didn't believe that he was one of their top six D-men. We saw that in the postseason as well, where the Iron Man streak gets put aside and you don't have to worry about it. He was not part of the future plans. An acquiring team has to know that. And I do wonder if there are teams out there, Karen, thinking to themselves, do we want to put pressure on ourselves to have to play Keith Yandle? Now, if you're a team that doesn't believe it's going to be competitive this year and you're just looking to fill out your roster and you say, ah, we're not that deep anyway, we're kind of in that holding position where we're just trying to get through the season, okay, maybe you can bring in Keith Yandle. But I do think that competitive teams will think long and hard about this decision.
Well, 34 years old, he's going to obviously be going to choose where he wants to go. Does he want to go chase a cup but be a lesser part of the team, have the potential chance of being healthy scratch, Scott? Or does he go to a team, like you said, where he can keep his Ironman streak alive because their defensive core is not as deep and he'll get a chance to play? Buffalo is an example. Like, Keith Yandle's going to play in Buffalo. He's going to get his Ironman streak continued as long as he stays healthy. He's 42 games back of Doug Jarvis, 43 games to becoming the all-time leader in games, consecutive games played. I think you look at it, it depends to me on the organization. Like, do you have an organization that's willing to say, well, we don't care, we don't want that to be part of our quote-unquote legacy, the fact that we ended Keith Yandle's Ironman streak? Like, are we, you know, have enough confidence in ourselves in taking that hit on? Because that is a little bit of something that's always going to be tied to you when you talk about Keith Yandle's career. Okay, Joe Quenneville was the one who ended his Ironman streak. Like, he didn't think he was good enough, he ended it. So I do think that plays into it quite a bit, but I also think it plays into what Keith Yandle thinks is more important. Is it the Ironman streak, or is it going to chase a cup?
I want to get this last text in just before we move on here, Karen. Let me tell you about Shea Weber, says this texter, and his family. I coached him when he was 14, 15. The first time I met him, I was coaching a spring team locally, and this texter comes to us from the Lower Mainland. We practiced in the Lower Mainland on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. I walk into the dressing room. There's this kid I introduced myself to. He says his name's Shea Weber. I said, don't you live in Sycamoose? Are you taking the week off school? Here's a reply. No, we drove here today for practice. We are driving home after practice so I can go to school tomorrow. Then we'll drive back here for weekend practices. Then I saw him play. He's always done things the right way. He is the most underrated star defenseman of his generation, says this person who coached Shea Weber back in the day.
I think it speaks to he is a small-town guy with, you know, a humble guy, and obviously has great roots to pull back on, Scott, and it just shows, like, this story in particular and the fact that Jeff Merrick was on with the 650 Morning Show today and says, you will not hear a single teammate talk a bad thing about Shea Weber. There's never been anything leaked to the media, leaked out there on social media about anything that Shea Weber is not just a stand-up guy and a person. And I think that speaks, when you speak about his playing career, I think you have to speak about the teammate and the leader that he is in that locker room.
That's a similarity to our next guest. Never has a teammate had a bad thing to say about the star quarterback of the BC Lions. He is Michael Riley. He is at training camp, and he's on Rintoul and Sermon right after this.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
That's a nice story about Shea, as in Weber, but what does that have to do with him getting to the Hall of Fame? It's not the Hall of Amazing Human Beings, which I absolutely think he is. That's a reminder, Matt in Abbotsford. Has nothing to do with him getting to the Hall of Fame. It was just a story that came in from a listener. Minor, Matt. I think Shea Weber is a no-doubt Hall of Famer for his on-ice accomplishments. He doesn't have to win a Norris Trophy or a Stanley Cup to get that.
Yeah, I just think it points to the human being that he is, and I think when you talk about Shea Weber, it's not a Hall of Fame conversation, Scott. It's just about the player himself, and a player that is respected by his teammates, a player that goes about things the right way, a player that you think about the fact when he signed that offer sheet with Philly. Like, he signed the offer sheet because he wanted to leave. And he came back to that locker room and there was no ill will with the players. There was, you know, no bashing him from everything that we've understood. It was like, okay, thank God we have Shea Weber back in our locker room. And I think it just points to the fact that he's a beloved teammate. And that's all we were pointing out. That's all I was pointing out, at least.
I'd love to talk to Shea Weber about that because I don't believe he wanted to leave. I think he was prepared to leave. I think those are two different things, and maybe that's semantics, Karen. He signed the offer sheet to get business done. He wasn't getting contractually what he wanted from Nashville. Somebody put an offer in front of him that he and his camp went, I can't turn that down. I can't turn that down. Like, look at the money they're offering me. Look at the term they're offering me. Nashville's nowhere near that. I'm prepared to leave for that. To me, that is a difference between, see you guys, I'm out of here, I don't want anything to do with you, and look, if you'll match that, I'd be happy to stay. Like, if you value me the way they value me, I'm happy to be here. But I'm just showing you what other teams think of me right now, and I have to make this business decision.
And nobody knows what, or we don't know what was in Shea Weber's mind at that point. I do wonder, though, you think at the time, like, Nashville expansion franchise, you're going to sign this contract, but here's Philadelphia, a team that has a history, a team that has, you know, I can't go back and talk about their core at the time, but a team that has big money, hockey-crazed market. Like, was there any part of him as a Canadian growing up that goes, yeah, like, that'd be fun? It's not a Canadian market, but it's one of the more bigger hockey-crazed markets that there is. Was that any sort of indication why he was willing to sign with Philly? I tend to think, because he's a good guy, that he wasn't signing it to screw over Nashville at any point in time. I mean, the contract itself, Nashville had to come up with the money to be able to match that offer sheet and the way that the contract was negotiated, you know, like all those signing bonuses, and a lot of $13 million given out in the first 3 years. But I do wonder if something in Shea Weber's mind at the time was going, this would be a good hockey city to go play in. Nashville's not quite that. Maybe I go play in the city where it's hockey's second in terms of popularity?
There's a lot of players in every single league that are willing to play in a lot of places. Doesn't mean it's their number one. And be interesting to ask. Maybe we'll get him on the show one day, and maybe we'll ask Shea Weber that question when we have him at our disposal. We're going to have Michael Riley, the quarterback of the BC Lions, at our disposal here momentarily. And CFL fans who knew him for a long time as Mike Riley might be wondering why the name, why are you going with the full name? Out of respect for his late mother. It's been a tough couple of years for Mike Riley personally. He lost his mother in March. She always said to him, as the story goes, that I named you Michael. It doesn't sit well with me that you go by Mike. And so to honor her wishes, he is going by Michael now. And the quarterback of the BC Lions, one of the most prominent players in the league, now joins us on Rintoul and Sermon. Michael Riley, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. How is training camp going so far? I'm up in BC's interior right now. I know there's a lot of smoke. There are a lot of people wondering what things are going to happen because of wildfires. You guys are trying to get down to business. What's it like for you?
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I mean, I'm actually standing on the field here on campus, and usually you can kind of look out over, I guess it's kind of east, and see the mountains. Right now you can't see anything. So that's been interesting, you know, but we got work to do. You know, we can't let that slow us down. And the coaching staff and the trainers have certainly taken things into consideration. So we've been practicing at night the last couple of nights, and it seems to clear out right around the time that we start, 7:30 or so. So that part hasn't been too bad, but I mean, that's just kind of par for the course for this year, for this training camp, is expect the unexpected. You know, we obviously have all these COVID protocols and things like that. You know, so if you're worried about things that you can't control, you know, you're not going to be focused on football, because there's a million things that are out of our control that are just different. And that's just what we have to deal with. So, you know, we're not too worried about it. We're still getting work done.
Part of the work you got done in the offseason, as a lot of CFL players, some of them now former CFL players, did, looked at something else. And I'm not trying to make light of the wildfires whatsoever. Fact remains, you went through certification to become a professional firefighter. Given the uncertainty of the league that you play in over this past year and change, how seriously, Michael, did you consider doing something else?
Oh, absolutely. It's something that, you know, I think everybody had to look at. And, you know, for me, firefighting and you know, learning and educating myself about and getting certified was not just you know, something to pass the time. It became something that I'm very passionate about, that I do expect to do when I'm done playing football. You know, that's going to be my second career when I'm done playing the game. So it was an awesome experience to be able to get some time away, to be able to focus on that, you know, but also having to continue to train, knowing that there was at least a chance that we were going to play a football season this year. So, you know, I think it was an eye-opener for a lot of guys, and again, myself included. You know, when you're sitting there and you have plans and expectations to play for at least, you know, 4 or 5 more years, and you have a contract that's got multiple years left on it, you don't think that it's going to get taken away. And the pandemic, you know, it certainly didn't care what any of our plans were. So, you know, I started to look at what I wanted to do when I was done playing, and firefighting became pretty, without question, the direction that I'm going to move. So it was a great experience. I have a ton of respect, you know, for anybody that's in that industry, and certainly it's hitting home a little bit here being in Kamloops and knowing that there's guys out there guys and girls out there risking their lives to try to contain these fires. So, you know, it's something that I'm passionate about, but I think that a lot of guys, you know, you've seen, have talked about, you know, getting into other things, you know, Burnham coming out, talking about studying astronomy and things like that. So it's opened up a lot of different avenues, but for this moment in time, we're excited to be on the football field again.
Michael, going into training camp, there's always a couple of things on your mind. Either it's, you know, you're building off a title and you want to continue that, or it's you want to rewrite the narrative of the season before. And I know that was kind of the expectation going into last season before it was canceled based on the disappointment of 2019. But what is it like this season? You know, it's kind of like an open slate in the CFL.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is really weird, you know, because of that massive time difference that's gone on. You know, there's big changes every single year in our league because of retirements, because of 1-year contracts, because of coaching changes and things like that. And then you add on an entire extra off season. You know, for teams like us that obviously had a very disappointing 2019, that's become an exciting opportunity for us to say, hey, you know what, 2019 was so long ago and we've had so many changes here that has no bearing on what, you know, 2021 is going to hold. And then on the flip side of it, I think you have teams like Hamilton and Winnipeg that are trying to hold on to that and say, well, we were really good in 2019, so we didn't make any changes. We're going to be really good in 2021. So you have teams on both ends of the spectrum that are kind of looking at things a little differently. But honestly, I don't think 2019 has any bearing on how anybody's going to do in the league in 2021. Anybody that's coming out with preseason rankings and things like that, they don't know a damn thing. I mean, honestly, this is a totally different league than 2019 was because guys that were great players, some of them are still going to be great players. Some of them are going to be over the hill and past their prime since the last time you saw them on the field. And there's going to be young guys that we don't know anything about that are going to step up and have amazing seasons. So, you know, right now I'm just excited to see what our team's going to be, you know, because I don't think anybody has any idea. We have really high expectations, as every team does at this time, you know, in the league when everybody's 0-0. But yeah, you know, I think that there's guys that have had great careers that are still going to be great players, but there's going to be teams that have expectations like, hey, we did this in 2019, so we're going to do it in 21. And no, you're not. You know, this is you can't live on the past. You got to come out and prove yourself every year. And I think teams know that. But certainly, teams that struggled in 2019 are looking at this as a really great opportunity for sure. And we're one of those teams.
Michael, you just mentioned right there, you're excited to see about what this team can be. It's your first time in a training camp with Rick Campbell, who, of course, came on 2 years ago. What have you seen, or is there an identity that Rick is trying to install on you in these first few days in training camp?
Yeah, he's definitely a unique personality and a unique coach. I don't think I've ever really played for anybody quite like him. But I know that he's been very successful in his career. And now, having spent 18 months getting to know him, or however long it's been since he was hired, and then also, you know, this last week and a half that we've been here in Kamloops, I can see why he's been so successful. I mean, he's very even keel, very, you know, calm demeanor, and doesn't get really too high or too low about anything, which right now is great because of all of the uncertainty on all the craziness of COVID plus these wildfires and things like that. You know, it's just, he just shows up and, hey, we got a job to do and we're just going to figure out the best way to get it done. And we're not going to worry about all this other stuff. You know, and I think that kind of transfers to the players where they show up and say, okay, you know, we're here to work. He's got a very good sense of humor, you know, and I think that he catches guys off guard with that a little bit. So that also has rubbed off. Guys are really enjoying the process and having a lot of fun. But I think a big thing is that he cares about the guys, you know, and this is a business, of course. You know, we're here to win games, and not everybody that's in training camp is going to be a part of the team. That's just, you know, obvious mathematical equation where we have 100 guys here and we certainly aren't going to be playing the season with 100 guys. So not everybody's going to make it out of camp, but you know, while you're here and while you're putting on this jersey, I really do think that Rick Campbell cares about you as a person. You know, obviously as a football player, but also as a person and tries to make this a great experience for everybody. So, you know, I think that the guys have really bought into his system and, you know, they're willing to do anything that he says, because they believe that, he knows how to get the job done. So it's been a great start to camp, and I expect that to continue.
BC Lions quarterback Michael Riley joining us this morning on Rintoul and Sermon. Since you last played, your former team in Edmonton has a new nickname. They've had two different coaches, neither have yet coached a game for them. Nick Arbuckle right. was with Ottawa. Now he's in Toronto. There's a bunch of dudes who retired. Others found different lines of work. Michael, there's a lot of fans out there who need refreshers on the league. Do you need a refresher on where players are and what this league is right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like each week you're going to show up to play a game and you're going to be like looking through your scouting and saying, I can't even remember that this guy played on this team, you know? It kind of goes back to what I was talking about a few minutes ago. There having been so many changes that who knows, this is just going to be a crazy season. And it's going to be fun and exciting, but I don't really know what to expect out of each team. And, you know, and then you couple that with the fact that we're only playing 14 games instead of 18. So each game is that much more important that it's going to be wild. You know, I think it's going to be a great experience for the fans, and I'm excited to see how the season plays out. But yeah, you think LaPolice is in Ottawa. And as you mentioned, Mike Nichols has been on Toronto's roster and now in Ottawa. Just all these different changes. And then I spent so much time in Edmonton, and we play them twice this year, but we don't ever travel to Edmonton. So that's a weird thing on the schedule, too. So they're just, expect the unexpected this year for sure.
So part of this unique season, for those who don't know, is that there are no preseason games. August 6th, your first game against the Saskatchewan Rough Rider, that'll be the first time really under the lights other than inter-squad games and scrimmages that you guys have during the course of training camp. Preseason games, I heard Dave Dickinson talk about it the other day. He said, receivers in particular, I feel like you can make a lot of catches in practice, but I need to see you when the lights are on to really know what I have. So how do you get an accurate feel for what you have in BC this year prior to that opening game?
Yeah, that's certainly a challenge. I mean, preseason is always interesting in the CFL because we only have two games, and so different teams choose to operate differently with what they're going to do with those two games. But, in the last 6-7 years of my career, I've played like one drive of one preseason game each year. So, it's not that big of a change for me to not have preseason games. But the biggest challenge is going to be every year, if you want to be a great team in this league, you've got to have, a group of young guys, rookies to the league that step up and make your team better and are contributors on game day. And that's really hard to figure out who those guys are going to be when you don't have these preseason games. You got to make those decisions based on scrimmages because, of course, you're not going to be going full go live like you would in a game during scrimmages because you're playing against your own team, right? And so things are just always a little bit different. Even if you try to make scrimmages as close to simulated games as you can, it's just not quite the same. So for us, I look at our guys on the side, on the offensive side of the ball. Luckily for us, we have a group of veteran guys that have all have experience in this league and have proven what they can do on game day. So I'm not worried about them. Our wide receiver crew, all these guys are experienced guys. They're either guys that, I've already played a season with, or with Rhymes and Lucky, guys that I've been watching, playing this league, and they've had a lot of success. So we have a ton of confidence in that group of guys. Same thing, offensive line. All these guys are game-tested guys. On the defensive side of the ball, we do have some changes, and we do have, some positions that we're going to have guys play that have never played in this league. So that's going to be the challenge for our team, as far as those guys are. But, again, we have, a ton of faith in our coaching staff. And as I said, with Rick Campbell's experience, I know he's going to figure out who those guys are. But, yeah, there's going to be challenges. And I think you mentioned that it was Dave Dickinson that said it, and they're in a situation where, they're going to have some of those young guys be wide receivers that step up. So that's going to be their challenge, right? But each team is going to have, that issue. They're going to have one or two position groups where they have to have rookies step up and play. And, you're just kind of, for lack of a better term, gambling, right? Like, you don't really know for sure what's going to happen. Some guys come in and they tear it up in practice, but for whatever reason, the lights come out and you're playing the games, they just don't show up like the same. And on the flip side of that, sometimes it's just, they're not necessarily all-stars in practice, but they just have this thing for weird reason. When important situations come up in games, they're always there making plays. So, you know, yeah, it's going to be – there's probably going to be guys that get released that don't get the opportunity that would probably have been on the team otherwise if we had preseason games. You know, that's just the reality of this year, but that's the way that it goes.
We always call those guys gamers who show up when the lights come on. Right. They might not be great practice players, but then the opposite, I can remember way back in my playing days, the guys who did the opposite, the practice players, but disappeared on game day, we called them Northwest All-Stars. Do you have a term for those players that you commonly use?
That's right, yeah. Walkthrough All-Stars, whatever you could, practice squad All-Stars, whatever you want to call them. Yeah, guys are, you know, yeah, I've been around plenty of quarterbacks too, you know, over the last 13 years that they show up. And the first couple of days, you're like, oh, my gosh, like, this dude is amazing. He's spinning this ball so sweet, you know, when you're just playing catch on air. And then all of a sudden you put a defense out there and that ball's skipping 10 yards short. So, yeah, there's, you know, there's always an element of that. But, you know, again, we're led by a veteran coach who has been around for, you know, a long time and seen all of those things. And that's what gives you confidence for sure.
Michael, you've been in this league for a very long time. You've seen a lot over your career, and you've got some other veterans on this team. You know, Joel Figueroa, Hunter Stewart, Peters Lee on the back end. So I can name a few, but you've never really been through something like last season and the uncertainty of kind of this season and all the COVID protocols you have to find. Like, is there any more pressure, you think, on this leadership group this time around, or leadership groups in general in the CFL? Or is it just, no, it just comes with the territory. We're veterans, and we're the guys that the young kids are still going to come to.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think that, yeah, there is an added pressure. I mean, I think the teams have to lean on their veterans right now, you know, to be successful this season. Because of all of the different things that we talked about, you know, the lack of preseason games, you know, the shortened schedule, you know, all these protocols where you're not getting, you know, we're doing some in-person meetings with smaller groups, but we're still, you know, for team meetings, we have to do like Zoom meetings and things like that. So you're not getting, you know, the normal coaching and teaching that you would. So there is an added pressure on the veterans, you know, to step up and make sure that they're leading even more so than normal. But at the same time, you know, I think the second part of your question is like, is this just kind of standard protocol? You always have to. Yeah, it is. You know, like there's just always pressure as a veteran to be, you know, doing your own job, but also being an example to the younger guys because it's such a priority, you know, to be successful in this league, to have a couple of young guys step up. And I keep going back to that, but it's because it's true. You have to have a couple of guys that nobody's ever heard of, you know, that really contribute and are not just starters, but are significant starters on your team. And so, you know, we gotta help, you know, the coaches. There's only whatever, you know, 8 or 10 of them or whatever there is. There's 100 guys here. So, you know, they certainly can't, you know, babysit all day. So that puts an added onus on us to make sure these guys are getting it figured out. That's the only way that we're going to be successful. But you know, that's part of the job of being a veteran. That's part of the reason why they keep you around, you know, and it's because you do your job really well, but it's also because you help other guys do their job well.
Michael, one final question for me. Did you finish construction of your house in this COVID pandemic?
Well, finish is a very loosely based term, I think. it's livable. All of the big work has been done. I actually spent a lot more time doing exterior and landscaping work than I thought I was going to have time for. But, you know, there is some except for on the top floor, all the trim work has not been finished. So the problem is that when you leave something open like that, you always think you're going to get around to it. And then, like, 10 years later, you still haven't gotten around to it. So, you know, I'm sure Emily will be on me to get that finished when the season ends. But, you know, we'll see how long I let that one play out.
Well, like many of our listeners, and this person in particular, you probably have a home of half-finished jobs. Half-finished jobs. That's what it's all about when you're a homeomer, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know,
Michael, get back to
I had to get the house to a point where she didn't have to call in somebody to do emergency work. And after that, my job's done, you know, whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I know you got meetings to get to and you've got film to study, so get back to that. Have a very healthy and safe training camp. Look forward to seeing you on the field here pretty soon.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on. It was great talking with you both.
Thanks, Michael.
You as well. That is Michael Riley, quarterback of the BC Lions. Not only one of the great players in the league, one of the great personalities in this league.
Yeah, I had to ask him that question because I traveled with the BC Lions in the 2019 season as their sideline reporter for the radio broadcast. And I remember talking to him. He would usually sit in front, the quarterbacks would usually sit in front of us on the plane, Scott. And almost every flight, it was about construction of his new home. So I had to ask him if in the pandemic he had finished it. But again, like you say with most homers, there's always something else to do.
Half finished. I can't tell you how many half finished jobs there are at my home right now. Got it started. Oh, I just got a little bit left to do. I'll get to it tomorrow. Tomorrow never seems to come with some of those jobs. He's worried about construction of his football team right now as the rest of the Canadian Football League. It's going to be a wild season. Not going to really know what any of these teams have till the lights go on come August, and everybody's looking forward to that. Some interesting notes and nuggets put out there today by an NHL insider. We will get to that. And are people missing a great one? You tell me. I'll tell you what I'm referring to next on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
I don't think we would have got an honest answer if we'd asked it that way, Taj the Blueberry guy. It's Rintoul and Sermon. Will someone actually block for you, Michael Riley? I can't do another year of watching Michael Riley run for his life. That has not just been the case in his first year with the BC Lions. His first year in Edmonton, Karen, I've said this many times on air, NFL, CFL, any level of football, I have never seen someone take so many hellacious hits and get back up every time. That first year in Edmonton, when he signed out of BC, they couldn't keep him because they had to get the loop done and Michael Riley was due for a raise and they couldn't make it all work. So they traded him to Edmonton, got the deal done there. He was a human pinata back there. It was turnstile on that O-line, and he kept picking himself back up, and yet it fortified him as a leader in that organization. And every single player, he never threw an offensive lineman under the bus the entire time. I don't know if you remember that year. Ed Hervey actually threw one of his offensive linemen, Simeon Rodier, under the bus at the time, and it was pretty public, and that's a different story. Riley just kept getting back up, frustrated as he might have been, as in pain as he might have been, and he kept going to bat. He kept taking snaps, and it really set the foundation for what would become a championship team in Edmonton a couple of years later.
Yeah, and 2019 was basically the exact same thing, Scott. That offensive line was, it was supposed to be good. They brought in some free agents, specifically Su Chung, to help on that offensive line after he'd had some great seasons with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. He was coming home, and to start the season, it was just a nightmare. And you talk about, we talk about Shea Weber and putting his body through things. Like Mike Riley, you talk about his first season in Edmonton, Scott. You look at that 34-year-old Mike Riley taking the hits that he took for the BC Lions in his first year a couple of years ago. It was painful to watch from the sidelines because you hear it from the sidelines. It's painful to watch on TV. Same thing. He never once, you know, came at his offensive lineman on the sidelines. He never publicly came at his offensive line. Called out a couple of times, maybe by his head coach, but they did make the change at the coaching staff. They've got a veteran presence. As long as they're healthy, I think Mike Riley will be, hopefully, cross our fingers, not running for his life as much as he did in 2019.
It's good for the league to have the Stars healthy, no matter who you cheer for. If you're a Stamps fan, a now Elks fan, if you are a Bombers fan as opposed to a Lions fan, you want the Stars healthy. We talk about this all the time. The league is better when you have its most prominent players available. And based on that interview, for those who'd never heard Michael Riley before, he is also one of the great personalities. You want that guy around to sell your league. A couple of interesting nuggets from NHL insider Frank Saravelli today. Darcy Kemper, he is being pursued. Wooed might be the wrong term, but he is being pursued by both the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Colorado Avalanche. Seattle apparently interested as well, as they should be. He's got a year left on his deal. He makes $4.5 million. He's an easy cap hit to digest. He's 31. He's really good when he's healthy. More interesting to you if he winds up in Toronto, Colorado, or Seattle, Karen, if those three teams are the ones left standing trying to make something happen for Kemper?
Yeah, Darcy Kuemper, 27 games last season for Arizona. As you said, really effective when he's healthy. You know, played with an Arizona team that played a defensive style in front of him. I don't know if that helped his numbers at all. Scott, wasn't he also the goaltender for Team Canada at the World Championships this year? The one that won gold? Yes, so he's got that under his belt. Veteran guy, 1 year left on his deal. It's, what did you say the cap hit was at? I didn't hear that one. But
about
still,
$4.5 million.
Yeah, very manageable. Very, when you think of a goaltender, that's very, you could probably digest that if you are Toronto. There was something of Toronto today about Frederik Andersen and the fact that, that they didn't want him to negotiate or something like that. So I don't know what's going on in Toronto with Freddie Andersen, if they're going to try and negotiate and keep him. But it is interesting to think that the Avalanche, because are they going to have to go 4-4, Scott? And if they go 4-4, they've got Philip Grubauer, who's a free agent. We all thought that maybe they'd want to re-sign him. We all thought 2 years ago the only reason Colorado didn't make the Stanley Cup Finals was because of their goaltending. The fact Philip Grubauer is not healthy, he was their starter this year, just begs the question, is he on his way out of Colorado?
Maybe. And maybe Toronto and Colorado in a very similar situation. Freddie Andersen feels like going to test the market. If it doesn't work out for him and if the Leafs strike out, then maybe they come back and do a deal. Kind of like Mike Smith last year. Mike Smith wasn't going to be Edmonton's goalie. They looked at Braden Holtby. They looked at Jacob Markstrom. They tried to get somebody else. Mike Smith didn't have a gig. And they went, you know what, Mike Smith, come back to Edmonton. It might end up like that with Freddie Andersen, but the chances are pretty low. To me, this speaks more about their belief in Jack Campbell, whether it's from a health standpoint or you got to do it over 82 or whatever that number is for a goalie, 50, 60, depending on which guy we're talking about. We need to have a goaltending tandem here. It's not going to work with just you, Jack Campbell. The fact that they're interested in Darcy Kuemper doesn't surprise me. They'd have to do a couple of different things with the cap if they get him under contract. I do think it's more interesting what you talk about with Colorado, though. If he ends up there, is it in a deal to also help with their protection issue?
Yeah, absolutely. And just quickly, it was Pierre LeBrun with The Athletic tweeting out a couple of hours ago. For those wondering, Frederik Andersen's camp not given permission by the Leafs to, at this stage, to speak to other teams. Read into that what you will. So we'll have to be confirmed, to be announced when it comes to the Toronto Maple Leafs. Yeah, I do wonder when it comes to Colorado, because it looks to me like, I mean, if they protect three defensemen, it's Graves that's probably on the outside, right? And that would be a commodity that Seattle would want to pick up, or another team would want to make a deal with Seattle to get if they were to take him in the expansion draft. You have to think, Joe Sakic, what does he value more, going out to get a free agent goaltender on the market, or is it one of those, we value our defensive core right now and we need to protect Graves because he's part of our future moving forward?
And that's why I wonder if he's part of a deal. I don't think they look at him as expendable, and in a normal year, they would make sure that they had that core four back as far as the blue line goes. But if Graves is the fourth of four in their estimation, can you do a deal with Arizona? Is that a part of it? How can you help your protection issue? Is it somewhere else? The Landeskog complication doesn't help things here. It doesn't hurt them as far as protection issues go. It allows Seattle to go talk to him this coming weekend. Hey, here's what we can put in front of you. And as we spoke about yesterday when that came out, with him being a little disgruntled as to where things are at right now in Colorado, mm-hmm. contract-wise, maybe the grass gets a little greener. Would like to continue in Colorado, but if he can get a better deal, if it's significantly better, we mentioned this with Shea Weber and the Philadelphia offer. I fully believe Shea Weber would have liked Nashville to come to the table with an offer that was like that before it took Philadelphia going there and structuring in such a way that they thought Nashville was going to have no choice but to concede and say, yeah, we can't afford that. Well, they matched it. Does Landeskog get out there on the market and say, here's what I can get somewhere else? You guys come close. How close do they have to be? Colorado, one of those interesting teams that everybody is watching right now. I don't know how many people are watching this. I know you were last night. I tuned in for a while. You needed to tune in for the finish because Game 4 of the NBA Finals last night had one of the great finishes, not in NBA Finals history, but one of the great finishes that you're going to see in a basketball game, all because of this.
Now Booker with Tucker on him. Throws it up for Ayton. Shot blocked by Antetokounmpo. What a block from Giannis.
It's an incredible play. It's not at the buzzer. It is with over a minute to go, but it was the Bucks protecting a two-point lead. Looked like an alley-oop dunk for DeAndre Ayton. Giannis whirls, gets up, blocks it. It's a great rejection. I'm not talking LeBron on Andre Iguodala. That's game seven. That's the defining play of a 3-1 historic comeback for the Cavs. But that type of defensive play, you don't see every day. That was legit.
Well, and that type of defensive play may have saved the NBA Finals for the Milwaukee Bucks. Yes, they were up by two at that point, I understand. Chris Middleton had just hit a shot. Look, though, like you said, an easy alley-oop. Go back and watch the replay if you had it. That's about as easy an alley-oop as you're going to get from Booker to DeAndre Ayton. And Giannis doesn't give up on the play. He understands the significance of possibly getting this block. It's clean, it's beautiful, and the Bucks go on to win. No, it's not Game 7, LeBron James on Andre Iguodala for one of the greatest comebacks in NBA Finals history, but Scott, I'm going to put some importance on this, and I'm going to put some importance on because Ayton makes that dunk. It's tied. Who knows how the game could go? It was back and forth at this point. Phoenix could have easily won that game, and if they do, it's 3-1 series likely over, 3-1 deficits. Yeah, it happened with LeBron, but LeBron was on that team, and it's probably unlikely to happen if you're Phoenix up 3-1 against this Milwaukee team, so I will say he saved his season with that block.
I'm not going to go that far. It would have only tied the game up. I'm not going to say that play saved the season. I'm just going to label it one of the great defensive plays in NBA Finals history. I will put it there. We can agree to disagree on that. More to your point about Giannis and that play and what has transpired this series. Look, game one, we got the Chris Paul game.
Mm-hmm.
Finally gets to a final 16 years in, and he has a great game. We got a Devin Booker game in this series. We got back-to-back 40-point efforts from Giannis. We got Chris Middleton going for 40 last night and Giannis making that play. Are people missing a great series? Yes or no?
I mean, there's storylines, Scott, coming out of this and the fact it's 2-2 and best of 2 out of 3 going down the stretch. I mean, what more could you probably ask for in an NBA Finals? You've got an MVP who was injured and now he just looks like he's 100% healthy and he's playing phenomenal in Giannis Antetokounmpo. Yeah, the Chris Paul, the Devin Booker, they're coming out party for Devin Booker. But honestly, I don't know if I can still sell you on this. I wanted to sell the listeners on this prior to the NBA Finals. I said, okay, I'm going to go all in. I'm going to watch it. I'll tell you, last night, I watched part of the game, kind of distracted by it. I watched the end of the game, which was a great finish by that. But I don't know if I can sell the listeners on if they're missing a great series. I just don't know.
So are you saying that because you don't think the basketball is very good or because it doesn't have the sizzle that most finals have and we're so used to that in the NBA? Because the basketball is pretty good in this series, isn't it?
Oh, the basketball last night took me back. Did it not take you back to almost the 80s, Scott? Man, oh man, that was physical. I will say it's the only close game so far in the NBA Finals. I mean, they've been kind of one-sided in each of the first three games.
Okay, so I will take you back to that 3-1 historic comeback by the Cavs and the Warriors. There's only one close game, and it's Game 7. Every other game is a blowout in that series. But we had star power in that series. We had sizzle. We had the middle of a dynasty for the Warriors in that series. But that series was a blowout. In fact, the last 4.5 minutes of Game 7, I say this all the time, and everybody rolls their eyes. There was one field goal made, and it wasn't because there was terrific defense on every single possession. Only one field goal, but it had this great block, and it had a 3-1 series comeback, and it had star power all over the place.
Yeah, you look at that, the Warriors didn't score. They just couldn't score. It wasn't a matter of fact of just, you know, it wasn't great basketball down the stretch, but as you said, you've got the block that everyone says the block. Yeah, it's LeBron on Andre Iguodala. We all understand that. And the Kyrie three-pointer, but it's the LeBron, and it's Steph Curry, and at the time it's Klay Thompson and Draymond Green. Like, it's just the storylines make you want to tune in and night out. I will say, I'm going to give you props on this because you said you wanted the Lakers to continue to win throughout the playoffs because it's LeBron and it's always a storyline around LeBron. I just can't manufacture one in this NBA Finals, and I'm trying to, and it seems like it should be exciting, and it seems like I should want to tune in on Saturday night, but I'm almost like, well, it's Saturday night. There's probably something else to do. Maybe I'll PVR it, watch the highlights. Like, I understand the responsibility for the show, Scott, that, you know, be prepared for Monday to come and talk about the game, but it's also, you know, Saturday night. There's other things to do in the city, so I'm trying to convince myself, and I want to convince the listeners that you're missing out on something that has the potential to be special. I'm just not there.
You can't tell your heart how to feel. You can try, but your heart feels how it feels. As you watch this series, which team do you find yourself rooting for?
Well, I was rooting for Phoenix going in. Never won an NBA title. Chris Paul, I want him to have it. I want his career to be kind of in, not the guy who didn't win. I mean, what do we talk about Dan Marino? The guy who was a phenomenal Hall of Famer quarterback, never won a Super Bowl. I don't want Chris Paul to be remembered as that. I think he deserves to have a different narrative spoken about him when he's retired. I like to see it. I like the fact that the Phoenix Suns thought after the bubble, they're like, let's go all in and see what can happen. They brought in a guy like Chris Paul thinking, let's accelerate this rebuild. Like, we have the building blocks, we're now there, we only need one more player, let's go do it. I'm kind of leaning a little bit more though towards Milwaukee at this point because of Giannis, and he's, we'll get to this conversation, but he's a quiet superstar that you kind of have to, like, there's no reason not to cheer for him, if that makes sense.
Great player and seems like a great guy, as we'll find out on What They're Saying. My answer to my own question, by the way, is I do find myself rooting for the Bucks.
Yeah.
I do. And, yep, there's good storylines on either side, but I find myself wanting Milwaukee to win. I do.
Did you have that same initial reaction going in, or was this kind of, I'm hoping for a good finals, I don't really lean one way or the other, and now just based on the last couple of games and Giannis and the performances, that's why you're leaning that way?
I was probably 55-45 Milwaukee going in. I'm more like 85-15. At this point, where I really feel like I would like Milwaukee to win this series. Giannis Antetokounmpo, you talked about him. He's the superstar, a couple of MVPs, Defensive Player of the Year. Hadn't gotten over in the playoffs. Now he's two games away for an NBA championship, and yet he leaves the first quarter in Game 3. He leaves the first quarter in Game 4. What's going on? Here's what he had to say.
Giannis, this was the second game in a row you went out early in the first quarter. I'm just curious what was going on there.
I wanted to... What the hell you guys say politely? I want to take a tinkle? Yeah, yeah. I want to take a tinkle. It came back. Yeah. That's polite, right? Tinkle is polite, yeah. Both games. I want to take a tinkle and went back.
I hadn't heard that before, Scott. That's amazing.
It's great. It's great. I had to take a tinkle, and I'm trying to be polite here. That's the right word I'm using, right, guys? That's what I had to go do. It happened both games, and maybe he needs to adjust his pregame routine, or maybe because the Bucks have won both of those games, this becomes part of superstitious practice. I will come out of the first quarter of each of the games in the NBA final. I will go relieve myself and have a tinkle. Then I will come back. We will win, and then we'll go celebrate a championship in a couple more games.
A tinkle.
It's good. It's great. I like it.
When nature calls, nature calls. I like the honesty in it. Like, right, someone asking the questions. Well, yeah, I had to go to the bathroom, and I'm going to go use the more polite term in it. I'm going to use I had to take a tinkle. It happens to the best of us. I guess it's happened to Giannis and to the Kupo. Yeah, like you said, it will be seen how superstitious he is in Games 5 back in Phoenix. If he has to continue this, it's goodwill for his team. I just got to say this. Basketball Phil tweeted us on Twitter, Scott, and he said, if the Stanley Cup Finals was tied at 2, you would be talking about how great it is. It's tied at 2, best of 3 for the title. It's great. I'm not doubting that this is great for the NBA, and like if you wanted to try and draw list viewership, best 2 out of 3 down the stretch, the basketball's been back and forth, but like I said, until last night's game, it wasn't really close down the stretch. Yeah, honestly, if the Habs and Lightning were tied 2-2, I would have talked about how great it was. You know why? It's a defending Stanley Cup champions going against a Habs Cinderella run. The storylines would have drawn me in themselves. They would have. I'm just saying, these don't have the storylines that is just a natural draw to watching these two teams play. That's just my opinion on this whole thing.
And that was kind of the point of the exercise. I think basketball has been quite good. I think the series has been quite good. But trying to get people over that hurdle of perception is a very difficult thing to do, and it might take this series going 7 games to draw in the casual and then have them realize I probably should have been watching this all along. You mentioned the back-to-back possibilities that were realized by the Tampa Bay Lightning. Julien Brisebois is on top of that team as far as management goes, and now he's got to figure out what to do with his cap. He's got to figure out what to do with protection for the expansion draft. He was on the Fan 590 this morning. Here's how he says he's approaching the expansion draft.
Well, I think every team's got their own puzzle. We all have different pieces. Essentially, you're trying to assemble the right pieces to form a picture of your captain hoisting the cup on the ice. But we all start with different pieces. So even for us in Tampa, when Vegas came in, the pieces we had at the time aren't the same pieces we have now. The challenges we had at the time aren't the same challenges we have now. So that's what makes it different, is just each club's reality at that moment. You know, I'm sure everyone's trying to get a deal done with Seattle that can help their organization, and I'm assuming it would help Seattle as well. That's why they would do it. But the reality is Ron Francis can only cut so many deals probably. So it'll be interesting to see how many of those deals do take place at the end of the day. I know I have ongoing conversations with Ron, but it's also very possible at the end of the day that I'm just going to submit my list and they're going to claim a player, and that's what my that's just the reality. And my owner got to cash a nice check from the expansion fee, and now we move on. Now we try to. With the pieces that are left, we try to assemble the best team possible to go on another run next year.
Some of it's financial with Tampa Bay. There are players they would love Seattle to take, because not only do you get, you're going to lose a player, but you get that contract off your books. It gives them a little more financial wiggle room. They got problems because they have to protect Kucherov and Stamkos. Stamkos in particular, they would protect Kucherov. Stamkos, maybe not. Would you take the captain? It'd be a tough conversation. He's not waving. There are some dudes that they might have to trade. This comes down to a really simple decision, Kieran. Do you want something or do you want nothing? Like, let's say you're going to lose Anthony Cirelli. They'll probably find a way to protect him, but let's just use him as an example. Maybe it's Eric Chernak. If you're going to lose one of them, do you want something for that player? Or do you just say, rip the Band-Aid off, because then we don't lose two players that we are considering as possibilities on this team moving forward?
I think a lot of GMs are just going to look at this and say, well, the ask is too high from Ron Francis. Any sweetener that we're going to throw in, and that sweetener could probably be a draft pick, like, I'm going to need this in a flat cap era, so I'm just willing to bite the bullet. And if you're Tampa Bay, maybe you look at your system and go, we've always been able to fill that position within what we have. So we have the assets already in, say, Syracuse, or younger players that we saw at points in this season play for our team. I honestly think Julian Breesbaugh is just going to go, look, I'm not paying you too much. I need what I have left, and I guess I just got to bite the bullet on a player.
I don't disagree with you on that. I'm talking about with the rest of the league, because you can get in front of this, and you have a decision to make if Vancouver comes calling or LA comes calling and says, look, okay, I know Eric Chernak is generally worth more than, let's just use a hypothetical, a second-round draft pick or a third-round draft pick. But here's the deal. If Seattle takes him, you're getting nothing. So would you rather have something or would you rather have nothing? And that's the conversation that's being had right now. And in the next 48 hours, we're going to find out if one of these teams that's sitting at that table that doesn't have protection issues, and Vancouver's a good example of this right now, they could use some lineup bolstering. Are they able to do it? Nate Schmidt was a guy that, I know it didn't work out particularly well last season, but that was a guy that they were able to get out of Vegas for a lower price than expected, because they needed to clear cap room to get Alex Petrangelo in. Can you do that with a Tampa Bay? Can you do that with a Carolina? Can you do that with one of these teams that says, we're going to lose somebody, we might as well get something? Can you talk them into that conversation? When this expansion draft went around the last time, teams didn't do that because Vegas said, you either deal with us or you deal with no one. Teams should be a little bit more savvy this time around.
Sorry, I didn't understand what you're saying there. I thought you meant just specifically Tampa Bay with Ron Francis and what sweetener you'd have to throw in for him. I do think that Julian Breesbaugh is going to listen to everything that's thrown his way. I think, do you want to lose two players off your Stanley Cup roster? Well, you're already going to probably lose a couple players anyways, because you're going to lose Blake Coleman and Barkley Goudreau to free agency if someone doesn't take them or you don't make a deal for them. I do think, honestly, like, you have to be savvy. You have to look at what puts us in the best position to succeed down the road, and kind of the cost-benefit analysis of losing one of those players. And do you just say, nope, I'm just going to lose one, but if I lose two, I can gain some assets back with a third team? It's that balancing act of how much am I going to willing to pay, though, to lose another good player but also gain something back. I mean they've got one more day, right? Today, well, two more days, today and tomorrow, to see what's going to happen. So far nothing has, but I do honestly think it's the just so many teams are wondering what the cost benefit analysis is and waiting for the last minute to see what Ron Francis is going to hold their feet to the fire, because from what we've heard, his ask is very high. So if his ask is, what could the ask be from other NHL teams?
Well, and apparently the asks from the likes of Tampa Bay, Carolina right now, it's pretty high. I heard that from a league source last night. I'm led to believe that teams around the NHL are going to wait till Friday, see if those prices come down. It's a game of poker right now. That's really what it is. What are we going to have to pay? Are we willing to pay that price come Friday evening if it gets to that point? Could be a pretty wild week in the NHL. I know we've been saying that for quite some time. We'll get to the calendar and why it could unfold that way throughout the course of the show. And how might the LA Kings be involved? They've got assets to spend. We saw them start to get out in front of the market with the Victor Arvidsson deal. What does that signal? What might this offseason look like for LA? Find out next. Jim Fox, former King, current analyst, joins us on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Some good questions coming in, and I think they're fair questions. We're going to talk to Jim Fox, LA Kings color analyst, former LA King as well. As we zip around the National Hockey League, there's a lot of interesting teams. Karen, you know, we had our lists of which five teams will define this NHL offseason, and a lot of our listeners put the LA Kings on that list. You and I didn't have the Kings on our list, but they had a great case to be there. We could easily put them there. And that was kind of the point of the exercise, that both of us saw Seattle and Buffalo as defining teams. And then after that, there's a lot of teams that you could make a case for, three through five.
Yeah, I mean, the LA Kings are interesting because when you go out and make that move for Victor Arvidsson, and obviously did help Nashville in protection issues because they didn't, I get, this is what you're talking about, right? They didn't want to lose Victor Arvidsson for nothing. Nashville, they get some draft picks in return from him and they can protect somebody else. It speaks to me, you know, like Rod Blake's looking at this team and he's going, can we in the Pacific Division somehow accelerate this rebuild? Maybe looking like what what the Phoenix Suns did in the NBA. A little different, but still, are you at the moment where you're going to accelerate this rebuild? You've got some young players that either you can, you know, build your team on moving forward next 3-4 years, or are those assets that you can do to go out and get some more veteran established players? And that's why LA is in this conversation, because they do have the assets that are always in the conversation with the Jack Eichel. LA has always been in that conversation. Can they go out and get a Jack Eichel? Now there's the, you know, can they convince Seth Jones to maybe go there and sign long term? Is that a potential thing to happen? They're in the conversation for that. So it's one of the reasons that they could be on our list of five. You and I didn't have them. But yeah, of course they are, because they have the assets to make things happen.
We're talking about Tampa Bay at the end of that last segment. We played the clip from Julien Brisebois and the questions he has to ask himself ahead of this expansion draft and getting cap compliant by the beginning of the season. And the text came in, wouldn't they, as in Tampa, rather just lose one guy like a Killorn instead of losing two and have a third round pick? Sure, I understand the logic there, but here's the other side of it. So if you're going to lose an Alex Killorn, but you view Alex Killorn as somebody who can bring you a decent return and then force Seattle's hand into selecting somebody who isn't going to get you that return, and it helps you with two different contracts coming off your books because you have to get to 81.5 by the beginning of next season. Like, there's more than a couple things at play here. If you want to do right by somebody on your roster, if that's what we want to call it, hey, Alex Killorn, for example, maybe he doesn't want to play in Seattle. And maybe you say, you've been so good to us and you've done so much for us, we're going to lose you one way or another. Can you give us an idea of where we can at least direct our interests right now? Because we're going to have to lose a couple of guys, and maybe we want to push you in a certain direction. Like, there's a bunch of different reasons for making deals. And then there's the one that the listener goes back to of like, hey, just let them take a player, live with it, and move on.
And don't you think, I just have a feeling that Julien Brisebois understands that maybe Alex Killorn is gone. Like, the emotion that he spoke about Alex Killorn, you know, almost brought to tears at his year-end press conference, speaking about what he went through trying to get back to compete for that Stanley Cup. To me, you know, it's the same thing as the Shea Weber emotion after the game. Did he know something? Does Julien Brisebois know something as well?
So, are there more deals to be made here in the next couple of days ahead of the expansion draft? The Kings made one. We thought it might be the first domino. We haven't seen a lot of activity, but maybe it picks up here in the next 24 hours or so. Jim Fox is the Kings color analyst, former LA King as well, and he joins us this morning on Rintoul and Sermon. Jim, thank you very much for making the time today. How are you?
Everything going well. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome, and thank you for being here. What did the Victor Arvidsson trade signal about the LA Kings' immediate future?
Well, I think it signals that the teardown is over and the rebuild has begun. I think all of the moves the Kings have made over 3 or 4 years here have been to acquire prospects and assets, and now it's time to package some of those together and use them for what they call warm bodies, right? Guys you know, guys who have been around, guys that have a style that you're aware of, and you know exactly where they're going to fit in to help your team. So it's still on the rebuild here. It's, you know, I don't think there's anything to say that they're a contender for anything right now. Of course, you want to fight for a playoff spot, and that's that'll be the next goal. But certainly that teardown is over, and the rebuild has begun.
Well, and it makes sense from an age stratification standpoint within the Kings roster. And I know this is overly general, but they've got some guys at the one end of the spectrum age-wise, those guys who won cups and are still part of this team and are important parts of this team. And then there's those young guys that you referenced, and they kind of need a couple of players in the middle. Jack Eichel, from an age standpoint and talent standpoint, is that. The Kings dealing for Jack Eichel makes sense if what, Jim?
Well, if... you know, what they're going to be asking for is, from what everyone's saying right now, is through the roof. Looking for 4 to 5 different elements as far as assets. You know, I'm sure Byfield's name's come up, so you're, you know, second overall for a second overall type of thing. But of course, you know, by now Eichel is certainly more of an NHL player, and he's established himself, all those things. You know, you have to mention that the worry is the health issue, and you assume it'll be taken care of. You'll set, all of that will be, you know, taken into consideration when the deal is actually done. Meaning, I'm sure the acquiring team will have a chance to, you know, have a doctor go over all the records, have a doctor examine Jack Eichel, all those things, you know, beforehand. That what might not necessarily take that many depth and detail, you know. Other deals, but with the Eichel deal, you have to go through that. It's something that's out there because the Kings are situated well again with the assets and prospects. That's why the Kings name comes up. I think you bring up a real good point, the age aspect. I think now what the Kings are doing, you know, they're going to try to acquire players that in 3 to 4 years will be you know, in their prime, so to speak, so that they can be there for a cup run. For instance, you mentioned an Eichel. Well, you know, Andre Kopitar has been the number one center here for the Kings for ages. We assume that the next time the Kings are competing for a Stanley Cup, Andre won't be your number one centerman. Probably be your number three centerman. So you're looking for that type of thing to take place and those types of players to come in. But I think your point is well taken. The age factor, not only right now, but what's going to happen 3 or 4 years down the road. And those players the Kings are acquiring, they're going to be in the prime of their career.
Jim, one of the other players that's been kind of associated with possibly the LA Kings is defenseman Seth Jones. Now, a little different because he's got 1 year left on his deal, and the expectation is for a team acquiring him and giving up the assets that Columbus is going to ask for is that it would be signing a long-term deal to stay in that city. And, you know, whether you look at LA as a wonderful place to stay long-term just in terms of the city, or maybe it shies you away from the lights and glamour of Los Angeles, but does that make sense? Because it is a player that's 26-year-old and in the prime of his career.
I think it is the player, in my opinion, that makes the most sense. I mean, if you can acquire a number one defenseman like that, then you have Doughty, who is, you know, getting up there, so to speak, in age. And Seth Jones, you know, will be 29, 30 years old in 3 or 4 years, so he's going to be right there. You know, the amount of ice time he logs, the different situation he plays in. But, yeah, again, you touch on a very important point, which is, this deal is not going to be made unless there is a long-term contract signed. There's no way you're going to give up assets right now for a player you're only going to have for 1 year and then be uncertain of how much you're going to have to pay him. You want that deal locked up, whether he needs to do it, you know, and it doesn't really happen that much in the National Hockey League, but a sign and trade so he can get the extra year, you know, signing with his current team, and then the trade takes place so he has that extra year carrying forward. But to me, he is the name. Just when I look around, he's the name that jumps out to me more than anyone.
We've also heard the name Brandon Saad, thrown around in relation to the LA Kings. Does that make a fit, or do you think that's a fit for this LA Kings roster?
I think it's a fit for a player who's been there before, a player who's won before, a player who plays in a lot of different situations. Not a star player, so to speak, but the type of player that perhaps the younger kids can learn from. With Brandon Saad, I don't expect him to be in his prime by the time the Kings are ready to really compete for a Stanley Cup. But you always need those bridge players. And, you know, when Dean Lombardi went through the rebuild that the Kings, you know, led up to the 2 Stanley Cups, he had 3 or 4 players like that that were bridge players that were there just to teach and mentor. And I think Saad fits into that. And I think that's why his name is circulating around the team like the Kings, where you have that younger group that really needs the mentoring right now, because you want to set them up for 3 or 4 years down the road. And Brandon's that type of player who, you know, he's been there, he's won Stanley Cups, he can play at tempo, he's a good skater, so he has that. And it's just sharing all that experience and trying to get the young kids to learn.
LA Kings color analyst Jim Fox joining us today on Rintoul and Sermon. There are a lot of prospect gurus out there that rate the LA Kings as having the best prospect pipeline right now in the National Hockey League. Are there any players, whether it's Byfield, whether it's Turcotte, or anyone in your opinion, who are untouchable in that pipeline right now?
I'm going to be short here. No. I think everyone is available. I think, again, the Kings have built this pool of prospects specifically for the timing. When is that time going to happen where they're going to package some of these prospects, like we talked about when we first came on here this morning, and just, you know, make that next step? When is that going to take place? I don't think the Arvidsson deal is maybe it's just opening the door to that, but I would assume there's going to be some bigger deals as far as, again, players that would be your number one centerman, your number one defenseman, those types of things. So the Kings probably have, I would say, 7 to 8, which I would consider prospects that, you know, the scouts and everyone say, yes, they will be NHLers. There'll be 400 game played NHLer for sure. Will they go to the next level? I think if you hit on 2 or 3 of them, your batting average is going to be pretty good. So, again, it's just a matter of, taking all of that, sacrifice that you have to go through for 3 or 4 years or 5 years or how many years it takes to really get that pool of prospects there. But now you have to use them. I'm not sure if it's going to happen this summer, but if it doesn't happen this summer, I certainly think by the end of next trade deadline and going into next summer, I think the big move will be made.
This is a really proud organization, one that's not that far removed from its greatest period in team history. Obviously, there's internal pressure to be better and to compete again. What about from the market? Is there market pressure in Los Angeles to get back to a place where people are talking about the Kings contending?
Well, yeah, there always is. You know, your fan base is going to be eager to get to that mountaintop again. You know, before it ever happened, you're unsure. You don't know. Now you know what it's like. Now you know what it feels like. And now you know what the celebration is like, not only for the players and the management, for the fans. So they know that. So, yes, they're chomping at the bit a little bit right now. But I think the people that follow it closely also know that the rebuild that took place, again, and I'm going to go back to the teardown that Dean Lombardi went through, then the rebound. You got to tear things down first. You just don't kind of stop it. And just in my opinion, I'm not a believer in doing it halfway and trying to win along the way. I think you've got to be real bad before you're real good. The Kings have gone through that. They're on their way up right now. But I think the fans that really follow it closely, you know, they can look back and see this is what happened. There is a period of time where you're tearing things down. There is a period of time where you're building up again and you have those bridge players. And then there's a period of time when you're competing in the playoffs. And once you get in, you have that chance.
So, Jim, you talk about Rob Blake saying, okay, the teardown's done. We're going to start this rebuild now. And do you think any of it has to do with the uncertainty of looking at the Pacific Division going back to the regular division next year? I mean, you've got Vegas. We know what Vegas is. But you could probably put question marks around all of the other teams in that division. Do you think the potential of making the playoffs this year is one of the reasons he decided to go, okay, now it's time for the rebuild?
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. I think that you look around the division, you know that, okay, are the Kings a contender for the Stanley Cup? No. Are they a contender for a playoff spot in most divisions? No. But now, you know, Pacific, you have a chance. Like you mentioned, only one, maybe two teams at the top. Other than that, you're fighting it out with everyone else. So, and I think the Kings felt that way this year in the COVID realignment issue where there was 2 or 3 teams right at the top. St. Louis kind of fell out. Minnesota took over. But after that, it was, you know, you had a chance. And with about, 15 games left, the Kings still had a chance. Then they really had a disappointing end to the season. But I agree with you. I think they are looking at the division. They're looking at the competition. And that is entering in into the mindset of, yeah, we're not going to contend for a Stanley Cup, but certainly a chance to contend for a playoff spot.
Anže Kopitar, 33 years old. What is he now at this point in his career?
Well, just from the fan voting, I know he finished top five, again, a best all-around player. So he still has that respect. You know, he needs some help. He needs some offensive help. As I mentioned, I think by the time the Kings are competing for a Stanley Cup next time, he would be your third-line centerman. He is an incredible athlete. He's an elite-conditioned athlete. He is a horse. You can ride him. He plays all kinds of situations. He had an outstanding start to the last season. And then about 40 games in, I mean, I basically said it. He's going to slow down here. It's just good. He was playing so many hard minutes. That will keep up for another couple of years. But again, I think his minutes will start to go down a little bit, and that has to happen. Someone has to take over for him. And also, maybe even with a player like Arvidsson, what it's going to be like for Anže to play with a player like that, if that indeed happens. Anže has been the type of player over the last, even in the Stanley Cup, he was never probably, you know, on that, the most, you know, prolific offensive line, but because of his two-way play, I mean, the effectiveness and value by the end of a game, by the end of a five-game segment, by the end of a month, and then by the end of a season, he just comes right to the top. But again, if you're relying on him to carry the load like he did in the past, then I don't think the Kings are going to go anywhere. They know they have to have someone take his place.
In conversation with Jim Fox, LA Kings color analyst this morning on Rintoul and Sermon for a few more minutes. Drew Doughty, he shoots from the hip. He can be a polarizing player to fan bases around the National Hockey League. And there's been quite a debate about where he's at in terms of level of effectiveness over the last couple of seasons. You see him game in, game out. Where is his game at in your mind?
Once again, I'll go to the player voting. I mean, they had him top three. Again, I know this, the previous year to this year, the unfinished COVID season, I think he really struggled. I think that was the first time in his career where he started to really understand that he had to be a leader. And I think that distracted him a little bit. And I think what we saw was a player trying to do too much. And this year, right from game one, it was a completely different story for Drew Doughty. He was right back to the focus. One of the biggest things, biggest strengths of Drew Doughty, I think, is his read of the game internally, each game. Some games they need more offense. Some games they need more defense. Some games they need a shutdown guy. Some games they need a quarterback on the power play. That changes from game to game. I think Drew's biggest strength is his understanding of that. He got back to that this year. He really did. Whatever the team needed on any given night, he was willing and able to give it to them. And I think he settled into that mindset, and he figured a way out to make sure he wasn't distracted, knowing he had to help young kids. At the same time, giving it his best and putting his best on the ice. And so from that perspective, if he continues to do what he did last year, not the previous year, but last year, I think he's right back to the top of the league again.
We're less than a week away from the Seattle expansion draft. Which player do you expect Seattle to take off of LA's roster?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know what? I'll give a cop-out answer. I really don't spend a lot of time on that. No disrespect to a team like Vegas because they built a cup contender right away, but I really don't think the player that the Kings are going to lose is an impact player. I really don't believe that. You know, the Kings are not in a strong enough position right now. All of the prospects we're talking about are not going to be involved in that draft because they're too young. So, you know, I think before the Arvidsson deal was made, I think it was Cale Clegg, a young defenseman that played a handful of games this year. But with Arvidsson aboard, and then you have to protect him, that might change things a little bit. Maybe a forward will drop off the other side. So that's what they're looking at. But I think right now, at least with the Kings, the way they're situated with the age group and who they have to protect and those types of things, I think you're going to be losing a bottom six forward, maybe even a bottom, you know, three forward. And you know, your top 4D or your top even 5 or 6D, I don't think you have a chance of losing. So I think the Kings are in pretty good shape that way.
Well, we'll see how good shape they're in by season's puck drop, because we had a lot of fans when we put it out last week. Hey, who are the top five teams that will define this NHL offseason? We had a lot of listeners, Jim, chime in saying the LA Kings are on my list, no question about it. So I'm really interested to see how aggressive Rob Blake gets here over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I think he's there. I mean, he is chomping. He wants it. Like we talked about a couple moments ago, the timing is the issue. And, you know, do you go for that big move now? Again, you've got to situate things. You've got to look at next year's free agents. You know, all those things, I'm sure that homework's already been done. But, yeah, he's ready. I know that. He's ready to make that move. Now, whether, again, it's right now, pre-draft, whether it's going into the season, whether it's next year's trade deadline, whether it's next year's draft, somewhere in the next 12 to 18 months, I think the big, big deal is going to be made.
Can't wait. I can't wait. We all love activity. I know it's not easy on the players, but we all love activity as fans of the National Hockey League. Jim, thank you very much for your time today. Look forward to reconnecting very soon in the future. Stay safe. Stay healthy.
Okay. Thanks, Jim, for having me. And be well, guys. Thank you.
We will. That is Jim Fox, LA King formerly, and now an LA King color analyst. Rob Blake's right there. Wants to make some moves. Does he have to wait one more year? Timing can be everything.
Well, and you have to look at the ask, too. Like, what are you willing to give up in your asset pool, in your prospect pool, to go after some of those big-game fishing, you know, the Jack Eichels of the world, the Seth Jones of the world? Scott, it's funny, because I know this is part of a bigger picture and a conversation that we're going to have, but this just strikes me as a perfect example of, no, you're not a Stanley Cup contending team next year. So how much of your future are you willing to give up in the moment to position yourself, maybe not for this year in a cup contender, but maybe push for the playoffs, which is, I guess, what they're looking to do. But to, okay, say, it's not about this year, it's about next year or the year after that or the year after that, positioning ourselves down the road, because he's built this incredible prospect pool and he's built these assets to have to go all in. But it's the fine line of, where do you see yourself and at what point do you decide to make that next leap to the next level?
We did have a listener chiming in throughout the course of that interview saying the Kings prospect pool is overrated, no potential elite players in the estimation of said texter, saying Byfield and Turcotte, in his or her opinion, I can't tell because it's unsigned, are overrated. We will wait and see, but potential, boy, it's tantalizing. That's what we all love. And when it's not realized, you only look at the upside. You very rarely look at the downside, but the question you pose, Karen, is a very good one. When is it worth it? What makes it worth it? That goes across sports, and we'll show you how next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.